From Sacramento, the Bishop's Radio Hour with Bob Dunning. Focusing on today's issues in the context of gospel values. Now, here's Bob Dunning on Relevant Radio.
That's me. Welcome to you on this beautiful, warm day the Lord has made. Appreciate you all being with us on the Bishop's Hour. And this is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. And we are glad right now to welcome in Ned DeLessie, the Executive Director of the California Catholic Conference, which represents all the bishops of the state of California. Ned, good day to you.
Good day. Good to hear your voice again, Bob. Wonderful.
You too, well, Ned. Hope your air conditioner works.
Yeah.
Summer arrived early.
I tell you honestly, I'm sitting outside right at the moment.
Oh, very good. Very good. Well, hopefully the sea breeze will blow on you. First off, we are celebrating, I don't know who's celebrating it, but we're commemorating it, the 50th anniversary of the California Catholic Conference.
That's correct. 2021 is the 50th anniversary.
Wow.
The California Catholic Conference, the bishops had a big celebration back in February.
Mm-hmm.
It was part of February. The conference was started in January 50 years ago, and they celebrated right at the beginning of February with a virtual celebration.
Yes, so, yes.
And it is that time, and it was a different world back then, but yet we still maintain the commitment that we have.
Indeed. In fact, I've been so impressed with the conference and Catholic Charities and Sacramento Food Bank and on and on and on, redoubling their efforts during the pandemic because the need was there.
Definitely. Yeah. It's one of those not often touted facts that the Catholic Church is the largest private provider of social services, education services and healthcare services in the state.
Yeah. Yeah, every now and then you get into one of those discussions, we call it, with a friend or an acquaintance or just a stranger who knows you're involved in the Catholic Church and say, oh, they come up with something they don't like. And I say, okay, let's just imagine just in the state of California that the Catholic Church never had existed, never came about. Do you realize how many holes there'd be in that safety net?
That's right, and I was talking the institutional presence, and then
right.
You have the St. Vincent de Paul societies and the sodalities, and
right.
And all the different outreach groups that we have in different parishes, and those who show up to feed the hungry in parishes, those who take in Family Promise of the homeless people, and
the Life Center and all kinds,
that's correct. Yeah. And the Body of Christ is alive and well, and we're out there present. Trying to touch and heal and be present to and the people in need in the state.
Indeed. So how much do you know about 1971 when the conference was founded? Was this a new thing nationally? Was this prominent in some areas? What were we doing sort of prior to that in terms of legislation, et cetera?
We'll have to let the listeners know that Bob wasn't born back then.
That's right. I have to go to confession now.
Prior to 1971, the church was involved in public policy to a certain degree. The Archdiocese of L.A. Hired a lobbyist who was working up here. But the primary issues at that time were the Catholic schools,
mm-hmm.
And that was probably the biggest institutional presence of the church that they were working on at the time, certainly a certain amount of Catholic Charities, but the lobbyist was doing a lot of Catholic school work at that time, and
mm-hmm.
And that eventually transformed into currently Bishop John Cummins, mm-hmm. who at that time was not a bishop,
right.
But was a Monsignor, and he was invited to be the first president of the California Catholic Conference and came to Sacramento. He also became an auxiliary bishop here briefly.
Mm-hmm.
He served here in Sacramento as the conference director and eventually became the bishop of Oakland. And in a small world, he's the man who hired me. So,
oh, well. Wow.
And then after that, he worked as a bishop of Oakland until he retired. And
right.
He was present at the virtual thing, which was so wonderful. The he was replaced eventually by other priests, Monsignor Dickey from San Diego, mm-hmm. And Father Bill Wood is a Jesuit from, the third one was may he rest in peace, Cardinal Archbishop Leveda.
Oh, wow.
Leveda. He came here and was the conference director also, and then he was replaced by a Jesuit priest, Father Bill Wood, who was replaced by a diocesan priest from Fresno, Monsignor Peterson, who was, he lived at Sacred Heart, where did he live? He lived at Holy Spirit Parish here mm-hmm. in Sacramento and then worked
Land
downtown.
Park. Yeah.
And then I replaced him as the first lay executive director of the California Catholic Conference. And now replacing me will be Kathleen Domingo, who is the first woman director of the California Catholic Conference starting July 1.
Wow. So are the other conferences around the country, were a lot of them started about the same time?
Correct. Definitely. Most of them. It was, sort of a post-Vatican II kind of response by the church. The church was invited to engage the world in a little bit different way, and the church was getting, organized. Up until that time, there were provinces and that type of thing, but there weren't really conferences, a state conference. There were, the Archdiocese of San Francisco was a province, and mm-hmm. then there were suffragan bishops that were under the archbishop there, and the same thing in L.A., but then when the conference was formed, then it became, those provinces still exist, but they're now all the bishops of California work together as a California Catholic Conference. And so many of the conferences, I'd say probably most of them emerged during the 70s. California was one of the early ones to step in because of the needs that were here.
Has the mission changed in 50 years?
The mission, no. The mission, I think, is still to evangelize in the public order. And, to be part of the public debate that helps shape from a moral perspective and bring our experience that tries to help shape the understanding of the good society and respect for life and respect for the dignity of the human person and care for those who are poor. And we would like a society that honors all those things. And so we're present as the voice of the church, the voice of Christ in the world here. And that has not changed. I think the focus of different things, as I mentioned, back then, the Catholic schools was a big issue mm-hmm. prior to the forming of the conference and continued to be and continues to be an issue along the way. But, there's also the social justice agenda and the life agenda and the family agenda and the religious liberty agenda and environmental justice and restorative justice. And so the breadth of what is engaged has constantly expanded as society has expanded.
Sure. You go back to 1971, pre-Roe v. Wade, barely, yep. And, of course, the death penalty was very much in the news back in those days, even things being on the ballot. I remember I do remember as a Catholic in the mid-60s when Governor Edmund G. Pat Brown got on a state helicopter, flew to Golden Gate Park, and participated in an annual rosary event.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and just I don't imagine that happening today. But it really impressed me. I also remember his opposition to the death penalty and all the hand wringing about the potential and ultimate execution of Carol Chessman. And
right.
and how very much that was in the news at that time. And of course he defeated Richard Nixon in 62, elected in 58, defeated Nixon in 62, and then finally lost to Reagan in 66 when he was running, when Brown was running for a third term.
Yeah.
Then the rest is history. It's interesting because I remember Richard Nixon saying at a press conference after losing in 62, "You won't have Dick Nixon to kick around anymore," and a few years later, he's president of the United States.
That's right. Yeah. Well, we share some of the same history.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yes, things have changed. The mission remains the same. The scope has broadened deeply. The culture has shifted and changed. From those times, obviously, there was a vibrant immigrant community from, you know, Ireland and, mm-hmm. you know, and from Germany and, you know, the European countries in particular, right. always an Hispanic presence from the South, but not as vocal and not as dynamic as it is now.
Right.
And now the diversity has expanded, you know, Filipino, Asian, you know, you name it.
Yeah.
It's, you know, the culture has shifted from that, you know, to be rather blunt, you know, from what was a semi-supportive or at least interested larger culture in religious formation, mm-hmm. religious presence in the society to one that is very secularized and very individualized and not supportive in many ways. And so it's unique circumstances, but again, the mission remains the same.
Yeah, I was reading the other day about, and I don't think this was the California case, but we see it every year at this time, some young high school girl, and you know, they have to give your valedictory speech to the powers that be before they let you speak, and she was going to thank God, of all people, for her success in life, and she may have thrown Jesus Christ into the speech too, and of course it was banned, and but she sought some legal help and it got turned around, and you thought, you know, she could have thanked a baseball star, a rock star, she could have thanked Madonna, she could have thanked whoever, you know, that would have been fine. But you can't yep. think, or probably wouldn't have been allowed to thank her parish priest or her rabbi or, you know, for guiding her along the way. And we still fight those battles.
We certainly do. We certainly do. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, the religious liberty has risen in stature as an issue that occupies some of our time and attention right now. Too.
And certainly during those 50 years, we flip-flopped a lot between Republican and Democrat control, the state house, the legislature, moved back and forth a lot, and that movement appears to have just stopped.
Yes, certainly at this moment, the Democratic Party is in the driver's seat, shall we say, with a supermajority in both the Senate and the Assembly, and since Ronald Reagan, I don't think we've seen a Republican administration until back to Pete Davis. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, and that means that all of the generally elected folks, superintendent of schools, and you know, and the different elect, you know, the lieutenant governor and the different elected state leadership is all Democrat. Also, so it's certainly a unique and challenging world right now in which to have a. You know, my own prejudice aside here, in which to have a quality debate about the actual substance focus of it. So that's a unique challenge for us as church right now.
Yeah, we see very little debate. We see a lot of I think both parties are guilty of this of putting the party first and whatever the party wants, that's what we want, you know, and we don't see a legitimate debate. You know, just going back over even the last 60 years back into Edmund G. Pat Brown, it occurs to me that in almost half of those 60 years we had a governor named either Brown or Gray.
I won't contest that with you, but it's just the moment that God has put before us, and
yep.
as the faithful disciples, we have to engage it, and we have to prepare ourselves, and we have to shift and change some of our arguments, and you know, and we're trying to stay on top of doing that, and you know, we're currently fighting about abortion and assisted suicide, as we always do, about school choice, about options for quality education for those in the public sector. We're now discussing, you know, mental health and how can we support and assist people with mental health. We're looking at homelessness, you know, there's so many different issues that are out there, and currently we're totally engaged, as we probably were not as much back then. We're engaged in the conversation about the state budget.
Mm-hmm.
Where the state spends its money reflects its priorities, and we try and make sure there's a priority for those who are poor and a priority that seeks the common good. And, you know, while we don't get into, you know, tax laws and things like that, we do want to comment about how the budget reflects our values as a society.
Yeah, and we've discussed this before. There's just no neat pigeonhole for the Catholic Church in terms of political issues. So many groups that appear before the legislature, you can pretty much put them on one side of the debate or the other, and not so the Catholic Church. I remember when you used to have what was the event called in April when you'd bring people up?
Catholic Advocacy Day,
where you would have four or five or six or seven or eight bills you were following and things that you were doing a lot of public outreach about, and some were sponsored by Republicans and some were sponsored by Democrats.
That's correct. And, you know, it is one of the gifts of the church, the charism of the church, is that when you're involved in moral commentary and you're involved in the experience of delivering the services around, you're going to have a little more, I like to view it, a little more comprehensive understanding of, mm-hmm. of the issues and an ability to relate to people on both sides of the aisle. You cannot, as you say, put our vision of the human person and the common good into a party platform. And that's a challenge for each of us as disciples, because we do live in this, and the challenge is certainly to, follow through and to do where, the Spirit's leading you, but also to remember that, God's in charge not the Democratic or the Republican person that you like.
Yeah, now, somebody said to me the other day, you long for, era you liked the best, things were simpler or easier or something there, and somebody said, yeah, but God picked you to be here now, so be here now.
This is the moment in time, and yep. We're struggling in a society that and one of my pet peeves, of course, is the fact that we know, and everybody knows, and science has validated that abortion takes a human life.
Absolutely.
And yet in our individualized and choice-driven society, we don't want to even discuss what would be responsible curtailing of the practice. And it's very frustrating, very frustrating. And, from a Catholic perspective, you have to find new ways to raise that argument and to bring it to the fore and to remind people that this is what's happening. Same thing, in the bill right now to expand the sad current reality of assisted suicide in California.
Mm-hmm.
So, all of the, we have a position, obviously, not supporting the notion of assisted suicide, but we have to argue this bill, which, you try and find ways to help people understand that, when you pass this bill, you promised you'd review it in 10 years, and now you're saying we don't need to wait 10 years. But you present no evidence as to why we don't need to wait 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And now you say all the safeguards that the proponents, said were so necessary to protect people are now obstacles to people's individual choice. It's like, that's the debate that we're having as a society. And so, we're engaged in that. And I pick those two, but, I could pick four or five other issues also.
That one is particularly troubling. And it's one that I don't quite understand where the impetus for it comes. Who's pushing this?
Well, the political push is from Compassion and Choices,
the
society that are ideologically committed to a person being able to control every aspect of their life, even to the moment of being able to take their life if they don't want to live in this particular reality. There's a subcurrent of euthanasia in there, and there are people whose lives are viewed not worth living, and you should be able to make that choice that your life's not worth living, and, possibly society should make the choice that some other people's life isn't worth living. And, they've tied into the larger culture of choice,
mm-hmm.
And marketed it that way. But, and again, I'm no objective commentator on this, but, the choice is usually executed by people who are well off, well educated, well insured, and living in that world of choice. But the people who will be victims of this are the people who are on Medi-Cal, where it's cheaper to ask someone to kill themselves than it is to provide quality hospice care or quality palliative care.
Sure.
And then there's a whole health equity argument that we're so much more well aware of right now in the pandemic, that certain portions of our society, African American and Hispanic in particular, suffer incredible health care disparities. And yet we're saying assisted suicide is something we should be discussing. You know, it's like, really? Yeah, really? In the midst of a pandemic, not enough people have died? So we don't have any mental illness problems. We don't have any suicide problems that have emerged in the midst of this. And yet, let's have a conversation about how we can make it easier for people to take their own life.
Yeah,
so, you know, I don't know. I don't get me started.
Well, you know, you are being objective, though, Ned, and you're seeing the truth, and that's and you're speaking the truth, and that's being objective, you know.
And trying to, I mean, I can, you know, get on my particular tangent here, and I believe firmly in it, but, you know, we have to find ways to engage other people in this conversation, and that's the beauty of an organization like the California Catholic Conference, that our job is to engage policymakers and their staff in these kind of conversations, to find ways to get attention, to find ways to engage the dialogue and say, you know, like, can we talk? Can we search for the truth? Can we search for the common good? Can we search for something that respects the dignity of the human person? So those are the challenging moments that we find in as the California Catholic Conference and the political order, but we each find them as disciples in this culture.
Yeah, you know, you use that term common good, and it seems if you go all the way back to 1789 when this republic started, there was sort of an assumption that you might have political parties and you might have disagreements, but that everybody was honorable and would work for the common good, even though they may have different ways or different opinions about getting there. I've become a bit distressed in recent years that maybe that's not always the case with some of our people that represent us in wherever, you know. And
that's true.
You know,
that's true.
More so than before, where we seem to have gridlock in a lot of places, or full steam ahead in those areas where one party or the other controls things.
Yes, I mean, we could, you know, take that into many different directions. I guess I would leave it as the fact that the American experience and its beauty has always been one that values the freedom and individual liberty,
right,
and the individual. But we've always been able to recognize that that individual flourishes when there's a society that supports and achieves the common goals,
right,
and things that help us all.
Right.
But now we find ourselves more on the side of I would say, worshiping the individual.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever that individual wants to do, that must be the common good, and it's not. And then, you know, you play that down the political realm and you find yourself, you know, with, 70 million people vote this way and 70 million people vote that way.
Right, right.
And so do we have a shared understanding of what's good for the society and what's good for the, can we discuss it? Can we debate it? That's the challenge right at the moment.
Yeah,
when you're in California in a one-party rule situation like this, that conversation is invited less and less.
Yeah, yeah. Has your access and relationship over the last 50 years, the conference, changed with the legislature? Is it easier? Is it harder? Is it, do you get more in-depth with them or less in-depth with them? Has it changed?
Yes, it's more challenging.
Mm-hmm.
It's more challenging of what I mentioned, the larger cultural shift that's taken place, where there's not as much value placed in the society and in the legislature itself on a religious voice or religious commentary. Not as much value placed on that.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, you know, to be brutally frank, that, you know, the church's experience with sexual abuse,
mm-hmm,
has not helped.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and so, you know, people say, well, gee, do we really need to talk to you? You know,
mm-hmm,
what's the downside of talking to you? And are we, you know, looking like we're, you know, in,
right,
in the current reality, we're looking like we're on the wrong side of this issue, on the wrong side of this, you know, this fence. And so that has diminished the church's voice, the church's access, the church's, you know, influence, if, mm-hmm, you will. And we have to accept that, but then start building and looking and working together.
Indeed. So in addition to assisted suicide, what specifically is the conference looking at now?
well, that one's dominated so much of our sure. time and attention.
Sure.
I would say, you know, budgetarily, we're looking right now at early childhood education,
mm-hmm.
and you know, making sure that as we expand that to the benefit of children and children go back into their educational settings, that we keep the diversity that has existed, the public-private partnership,
mm-hmm.
that we not have a one-size-fits-all public, you know, approach to that. But, and that, and for daycare, you know, and caring for children prior to that time, that we expand the funding and the availability of that, again, respecting the choice and the diversity of parents. And so we've been pushing that quite heavily right now. We've been working quite heavily on expansion of mental health, particularly for children,
mm-hmm.
because the children have experienced increase in suicides, and so we're hoping and pushing for the fact that the money that the governor set aside would follow the child. You know, let's not put it into public health or put it into public schools. Let's have the child be, and the parents of the child be able to determine where they can get that best access,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
whether it be a private school or whether it be a private provider of health, of mental health services. So we're pushing on that and supporting the notion of expanding access to mental health, but doing it in a way that really addresses the needs of the child in particular. So we've been pushing that pretty heavily. We've got some other issues that we're working on in terms of, you know, public-private partnership around homelessness. We'd like to see more contracting at the in the county level with our private providers like Catholic Charities. You know, we have like Mercy Charities Housing. They provide housing and that kind of thing, and the counties are committed to this. But one of the things that most people think is important in dealing with homelessness is being able to have case management, to be able to work with a person,
mm-hmm.
to help them deal with the challenges that have them on the street. And we do that, and we're present to them. We'd like to see a little more expansion around that particular arena. Run through a big list in my head here. You know, we want more visiting opportunities in prisons for families,
right.
and more supportive elements for faith and family in the prisons to help people with their readjustment back into the society. We're closing down the juvenile justice system in California in some ways, and the incarceration portion of it, and we want to make sure all of those children don't end up in adult prisons. And so we're trying to work to see some local solutions that would deal with children in a very, very different way. What else do we have going? You know, supporting a couple environmental bills, but I won't get into those too much. They've had to do with plastics recycling.
Have we seen data, Ned, on, you know, when a few years ago when we started putting the nonviolent people into county jails, you know, to serve out terms of longer than a year. Have we seen data on, was this beneficial? Is this good?
You know, I will not venture a guess because mm-hmm. I haven't been following that closely, Bob.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we could certainly follow that up with a program with some folks who do work that issue. And,
yep.
and that would be a fascinating conversation, all the transformations that are taking place within the criminal justice system in the last 5 to 10 years, and what has that demonstrated and shown. I think we could get someone to come in and share some of that with you.
That'd be excellent. What about your school choice? Where are we on that?
Well, I mean, I think at this moment where there's some proponents who are looking to do a school choice initiative that they want to title the Education Freedom Act. We're studying that and looking at it and deciding whether or not it's something that the Catholic bishops would endorse or support.
Mm-hmm.
It's a challenging reality in California with the control of the unions of the education, public education system. And so, but we're looking at that. I emphasize that the main place that we're looking right now is in the early childhood education.
Mm-hmm.
There was also a bill that just got set aside actually yesterday, but, there was a bill to put in compulsory kindergarten.
Hmm.
And, you know, we were studying that bill and looking at it for some time. And we like the idea of having children go to kindergarten. We like that, and we support it in public and private sector. But we wanted the parents to be the choice.
Uh-huh.
Not, you know, compulsory, but parents get the choice if they don't want to be compulsed.
Right.
And so, but that debate will move to the next year at this particular moment. But we're trying to keep the choice alive at the early early part of the educational experience, because I think that's when parents are needed to be involved. We're studying and looking at, there's a bill that's moving through that has what's called this ethnic studies curriculum, and that's somewhat controversial. And we're looking at the role of parents in that and how that can play out in the local school districts. Very challenging conversation. Sadly, the bill that would have required all the school districts to publish online their sex ed curriculum did not pass. It stalled in the legislature. And so
that's mind-boggling.
Yeah, it is mind-boggling.
It just is. I as a parent, I mean, would they say, well, we're not going to publish the history curriculum either, or the math curriculum or whatever. If it's just another subject, why not let us see it?
Right. And you know, as we testified that, this is part of the parent, the parent-public partnership
sure.
to educate children. And parents, certainly they need to know so they can assess whether it's the right thing for their child. But
sure.
Even more importantly, so that they can put it in the appropriate context,
exactly.
in the appropriate moral context that they can support and enhance and put it, in the way that it should be put into the child's life. And so, we were strongly pushing for that the school districts be required to put it up there. And then it failed. And, the only opposition was, the Planned Parenthood, now NARAL, and the trans community, the LGBTQ caucus. And in our conversations with them, we're trying to say, so if we're embarrassed about putting the curriculum up there, that's a different discussion.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a different discussion. One would hope that this would not be an embarrassing curriculum,
right.
regardless of where you feel on those particular
exactly.
issues.
Exactly.
One would think that it would be a responsible and respectful
mm-hmm.
curriculum that would be put forward. And so I don't know. It's going to come back again next year. We're going to push it and push it and push it because, 90% of our children are in the public schools. We want that public education to be a quality education, and we want it to be a reflection of the in loco parentis, that the publics are doing
Indeed.
This in the place of the parents and in cooperation and with the parents. So let's make it happen.
So are there any initiatives out there? I know the conference doesn't get as involved in the initiative, certainly. Once in a while, the bishops will say, we urge you to vote against such and such proposition, or are there anything out there floating? I see something dealing with sports gambling has made apparently qualified for the ballot, but I haven't seen much else.
The next big election is 2022 in
right.
November, and so the legislature has time to decide if they want to put different things on the ballot, and I would expect there would be some. I mentioned that there's a group trying to put in a school choice initiative on
right.
the ballot, and there's a number of others that are working. The effort around that will be a September to March effort to get the signatures and have it certified for a 2022 election, and so we'll hear more about that as the summer unfolds and we get into September. Those that have the backing and the financing and the ideas shaped will start moving forward. I would say there's a debate going on right now as to when the quote unquote recall election will be held.
Mm-hmm.
Most people speculated it would be November of this year, 2021,
mm-hmm.
and now there's talk that it may be in September.
Mm-hmm.
So people are buzzing about that around the Capitol at the moment.
Interesting. Interesting times. So, and
yeah.
Ned, just in a minute or two we have left, tell us a little bit about your successor.
Kathleen Domingo. We'll make sure that she comes on to have a chat with you and the listeners.
That'd it's, be wonderful.
Wonderful, wonderful woman. Native of Auburn, California.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of coming home, if you will, in some ways.
Yeah.
Worked at the Sacramento Life Center and worked in the Archdiocese of San Francisco, and the last 8 years or so has worked at the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, who's been sort of a counterpart in public policy and in our larger life and justice programming, and the executive director of that department down there. So she comes very knowledgeable of the church, very knowledgeable of the political world, and a wonderful leader and good administrator. So I think
oh, wonderful.
And good presence. very good presence.
And she will come aboard on the 1st of July?
Yes, she will be in this chair on the 1st of July, and I will move into retirement again.
Very good. Don't go far.
I plan to try and go quite a few places to see the grandchildren. So.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Well, yeah. God's blessings to you and your family and everybody there at the conference, and we'll look forward to our paths crossing again soon.
Likewise, and thank you for your continued interest in this and you know, your ongoing engagement with the life of the church and the world. Just absolutely magnificent, and thank you to all the listeners.
Yeah, thanks so much, Ned. Yeah, that's Ned DeLessi, the executive director of the California Catholic Conference. He came back on an interim basis when a vacancy occurred, and then now a new executive director, and Ned will go back into retirement, well-deserved retirement, and Kathleen Domingo will be taking over on the 1st of July. We'll take a quick break, back with more on the Bishop's Hour right after this. This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the St. Vincent de Paul Society. Drop by and shop at their thrift store, a beautiful, beautiful thrift store at 2275 Watt Avenue, open Mondays through Saturdays from 10 to 8 and Sundays from 11 to 6. They also accept donations at the store, donations of furniture, appliances, clothing, books, everyday household items. Your donations help to fund the many projects of the St. Vincent de Paul Society throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Do such wonderful, wonderful work, and the thrift store is one of the ways they raise the funds to help people throughout the diocese, and also many of their clients are able to access the thrift store for items that they need. You can give them a call. They will come pick it up as well, but you can give them a call. They're at 916-972-1212. And remember, again, the thrift store is open 7 days a week at 2275 Watt Avenue right here in Sacramento. Well, Bishop Soto refers to Christ the King Retreat Center as the jewel of the diocese, and indeed it is. What a beautiful oasis it is. It's located in Citrus Heights, right in the hustle and bustle of the city, and you feel like you're getting away from it all when you turn off the main road and just come into Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center. Christ the King has served Northern California and the Diocese of Sacramento for over 60 years through parish weekend retreats, individual spiritual direction, and a variety of other programs. For information on all the programs that they offer, including residential programs, give them a call. They're at 916-725-4720, or you can visit them at 6520 Van Maren Lane in Citrus Heights. And we certainly thank the St. Vincent de Paul Society and Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center for their fine and longstanding support of the Bishop's Hour.
Hello, this is John Watkins, Director of Catholic Charities and Social Concerns. You are listening to the Bishop's Hour with Bob Dunning.
That's me. Welcome back, and thanks, John, for all you do for our great Catholic Charities and Social Concerns. Man, there's a lot of need out there right now.
Oh, yeah.
And we're pleased to welcome in Laura Lynn Solano. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's nice
always,
to be here.
Every time I see you, I say, Solano County.
Yes.
Named after Laura Lynn.
I wish. Maybe there's probably some relation.
Does that word mean something in Spanish?
You know, I don't know. I've been trying to figure that out.
It's weird because, you know, I grew up speaking English.
Yeah.
And I never get asked, Does Bob mean something in English? You know, and I go, no, it's just Bob for apples.
Right.
Bob and Juan or something. Yeah.
It, right?
Yeah. But then when you see one from a different culture, immediately you wonder, does that mean something?
Yeah. I'm not sure. I mean, I've kind of looked it up before, like soul, sola, soul, maybe son, I don't know.
It's funny, we have an ongoing debate in my hometown where I grew up, and we have a street called Oestee Drive, and it's spelled Oeste, which is Oeste. Which means west in Spanish. But the person it's named for was one of the pioneer German immigrants to Yolo County.
Yeah.
And he said, it's Ost. That's how we pronounce it, because we're German, and I guess Este means east in German.
Oh.
And But the family pronounced it Osteen. I'm of the opinion that if your last name is spelled S-M-I-T-H and you want to pronounce it Jones, that's your right, right?
Right, right.
And so they call it Ostie.
Yeah.
And people that have lived there for a long time all call it Ostie because we knew the Ostie family.
Right,
we grew up with them. But the newcomers all think it's Spanish.
Oeste.
And they all say Oeste.
That's funny. Yeah.
And they say, oh, no, it's Oeste. It means west.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it is on the west part of town, which doubles the doubles the
meaning.
The fun.
Right. That's funny how, like, you know, my daughter, when she moved to school, it's, I mean, it's spelled Lebanon, right? So Lebanon, Illinois. But then over there, it's all Lebanon.
Lebanon,
right? You know, and it's like, well, I mean, depends on, you know.
Well, my wife's from Wyoming, and there's a town there, D-U, capital B-O-I-S, which would be Dubois.
Right.
But I guess in French. But they say Dubois.
Dubois, yeah.
It's Wyoming.
Yeah.
It's just, and we have St. Helena in the Napa Valley.
Yeah.
We have Helena, Montana.
Right, right.
You know, it's like they're spelled the same.
Yeah.
You know?
Gosh, there was one, I can't remember off the top of my head, but it was in when I used to work for the airlines. Like,
yeah.
And it would be, they tell me one, it didn't relate to it at all. I was like, that's not how it's spelled.
That's not how it's spelled. Well, I remember my oldest son, when he got through basic training in the Air Force, which was at Lackland in San Antonio, he got sent to Mississippi for, I think, radio school. And it's the base was in B-I-L-O-X-I, which looks like Biloxi.
Right, right.
But it's Biloxi is how they pronounce it there.
Yeah.
And so I'd call him and say, how are things in Biloxi? And he says, Dad, it's not Biloxi. It's Biloxi.
You figure out where we're
from.
Yeah,
I just, you know, however the natives want to say it, I figure that's the way you say it.
Exactly.
So Solano, we'll just let it go at Solano.
Yeah.
Well, I'm from Yolo County. I have no idea what that means.
Yeah, I don't know either.
Yeah.
I've lived there.
You only live once. You see the t-shirts with it. Yeah.
That's the new meaning.
Yes, the new meaning. Indeed.
Yeah.
Well, a lot to talk about. Mm-hmm. You're on the ad hoc committee against racism.
Yes.
Or about racism.
Yeah.
Obviously, hopefully, we're all against racism.
Right. Yeah.
And also, Encountering Christ in Harmony. Tell us about that.
Well, it's just recently. So myself and Antonita, who's a coordinator in youth and young adult, we've been talking about, you know, gathering, especially this last month was API month. And, you know, not too long ago, that document came out from USCCB, Encountering Christ in Harmony, which deals with the Asian American Pacific Islander community, which is large. So
especially in California.
Oh, yeah. And just the range, from Russia to...
So who's in that, under that umbrella?
Exactly. It's a huge umbrella.
Yeah, it is.
So, I mean, like, Russia goes from Eastern Europe to, you know, Western Asia. So from all the way there, and then you've got the, like, Pakistan, India, moving all the way over, you know, to, you know, Eastern, you know, Southeast Asia.
Right.
So you've got Laos, you know, Vietnam, Philippines.
Right.
And then the Philippines kind of is in the middle when you start hitting the Pacific Islands. Uh-huh. So, you know, you've got Hawaii all the way down, but you've got a lot of Micronesian islands in between. So you've got Guam, you know, the Federation of Micronesian States. Mm-hmm. You've got, you know, even the, various islands all throughout Indonesia, Malaysia. So that's a pretty...
It's huge.
Huge chunk. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then a large...
Sometimes you wonder, is it too big of a group? Is it not recognizing the diversity within that group?
You know, I think so. But it's hard to, like, where would you draw the kind of the
borders? It's kind of like, you know, most of my background is Irish.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody said, oh, you're European.
Right.
You know, I said, well, yeah, but I'm Irish.
right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess if you want to break into, like, seven categories, that's where you fit in.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And the you know, API is just, it's a huge one. But even, like, you know, just, I mean, I'm Filipino, and in our country, there's over 7,000 islands, you know, and low tide, right?
At low tide.
Right. And then even one island can have one dialect that's totally different than on the other side of the island. So, yeah, I mean, like...
Is there an official language, though?
In the Philippines?
Mm-hmm.
It's called Filipino, which is mostly Tagalog.
Uh-huh.
But, Yeah, again, there it's so. And then at that one point, English was a mandatory second language there. Right. So, right. Yeah, I mean, it's so diverse. And if you just think about that one country, you know, and then how many countries are within the API community, then, yeah, it's pretty diverse.
Was there a time, a specific time when you see this with a lot of groups when they came, when the Irish came, when right. the Italians came.
Yeah.
Was there a specific time when Filipinos came to this country?
Well, it's an interesting history. So during the Spanish galleons, mm-hmm. The Philippines was actually a hub of trade. Mm-hmm. So there were a lot of Filipinos when the Philippines was colonized by Spain, a lot of native Filipinos participated in the Spanish galleons. So mm-hmm. Those who ended up coming to the Americas, I guess that would be the recognized first Filipinos in right. America. So right. Morro Bay, there's even a large population in Louisiana. So
really?
Yeah, like wow. there was a village.
So did
yeah.
most come to the West Coast?
So that one was a small wave, and then uh-huh. you've got different waves. So when there was the pensionado. So like there were the ones who came during the war. So when the United States was participating in the World War, Filipinos also came over.
Right.
Then you've got the farm worker movement. There were a lot that came during that time. And then the 80s, there was a huge they call it the brain drain, where all the professionals mm-hmm. came from the Philippines mm-hmm. here, and then. And then also the military bases. So there's four significant waves, and I'm not sure about the latest one.
Right.
But most do come to the port cities.
Uh-huh.
But you'll find Filipinos kind of all over the world.
Yeah.
Kind of, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Pretty much.
Well, huge population here in the Diocese of Sacramento.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's very diverse.
And in the Bay Area.
Yeah. Yeah. And, it's funny because when I went to Illinois with my daughter, I didn't expect to see any, but there was an Air Force base nearby.
Oh, sure.
So, we ran into to a bunch of them. So, yeah, wow. it's very interesting where the different, ethnic cultures go, So it's mostly to find community. So, mm-hmm. like there's Little Saigon or, Little
Manila.
Oh,
sure. Yeah, I mean, you hear that all. There's Koreatown. There's
exactly. Japantown.
Exactly. Yeah. And we've always had the famous Chinatowns
yes,
in a number
yeah.
of cities.
Yeah.
But people say, why don't they assimilate?
Yeah.
And you go, well, yeah. when you come from another place
mm-hmm.
and maybe you don't even speak the language
right,
at that point
right.
You tend to I mean that happened with I mean you
oh, yeah,
still
the
see
Irish Italian,
neighborhoods
Polish yeah,
neighborhoods especially
yeah.
in the East Coast and
right.
the Midwest there's
yeah.
like oh no that's my brother-in-law who was Italian from mm-hmm. Philadelphia, and he said that in the Italian neighborhoods, they didn't ask you what neighborhood you're in. They ask you what parish you were
yes,
in.
Yes, yes, yeah. So, the parishes were pretty much,
exactly.
the majority ethnic in that
exactly.
particular area. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. it's, but, we're all guilty. I think sometimes we're guilty unconsciously,
mm-hmm.
but, at least we think we're trying. We think we have a good heart.
I hope so. That all there's
yeah.
good in people.
And all I need is we're all made in the image and likeness of
yes,
God.
Yeah.
I don't need to go any further than that to realize how wrong any sort of racism is, or any sort of sexism is.
Yeah, yeah.
Any ism really,
except for Catholicism.
Whether it's ageism, it's interesting. As I've got, I remember first seeing it, ageism,
mm-hmm.
when my mom was in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
My mom was a very accomplished registered nurse,
mm-hmm.
and she went into the hospital with an emergency heart situation, maybe in her early
70s. Yeah.
And people were calling her sweetie and patting her on the head and this is what we're going to do tomorrow in the surgery, and I wanted to say, this is an accomplished medical professional you're talking to who was just working 2 years ago.
Exactly.
Do you know what I mean? And it was the first time I had really seen it up close, how insidious it was. And I don't think that the people doing it, they weren't bad people.
Right.
It was just this sort of assumption.
Yeah.
It's like... Yeah, and all the isms are, they're
Yeah, I mean, there's a certain, you know, prejudice there. And like, and that's, you know, I think the hard thing is that no one wants to be guilty of it, right? Yeah. And yeah. But we all are guilty in a way, right? Yeah. We prejudge the situation. And sometimes if we act on that, then that can be discriminatory and racist, you know?
Right.
And it's not to say that, you know, like, we're automatically accusing that you're burning crosses or,
right,
you know, but, you know, it's like, how do we engage in these conversations so that we can move from that without automatic violence, you know, or automatic, like, you know, thinking the worst of the other? Like, how can we see?
Right. How can we really, you know, you hear a lot about dialogue, and somebody said to me the other day, accompaniment.
Mm-hmm.
You
yes,
know,
accompaniment.
It's a big word that it's loaded.
Yeah.
You know, that because it's so easy to say, well, I'm not a racist and that's that, and I don't even want to talk about it, you know, but to have more than dialogue to accompany, just looking at all the stuff on TV in the last few days about Tulsa.
Oh, yeah.
And I never learned about Tulsa.
Right.
Never. Yeah. I learned about it maybe a year and a half ago in anticipation of this. Some stories were coming out.
Yeah.
Last place in the world I would have thought had something like this happen.
Yeah.
And then now you hear about others, and I go, how come I didn't ever learn about that?
I think it's kind of scary to like look at the wounds of the past and be afraid that we might have blood on our hands, and you know, how do we deal with that? I mean, even like what happened in Canada with the boarding school.
Yeah, you know, Kamloops. A couple of summers ago, we were in that part of Canada and stopped in Kamloops for lunch, and we're just really charmed by that city. It's a nice, cute, small town, beautiful, friendly people, and kids still talk about Kamloops. Like, maybe if we were going to move, we'd move to Kamloops, you know. And then it was just such a horrible story.
Right? Yeah, and it's, you know, and like, how do we come to terms with that happened, and you know, how do we not necessarily move on, you know, like what I really love about Bishop Soto is like when he was dealing with the clergy abuse, you know, still dealing, he didn't want to move away from it right away.
No, like, okay, I'm going to deal with it, and then we're done with it.
Yeah, no, he was like, we're going to sit here, you know, and allow people the space to heal. And I think that's like a recognition of the wounds, like with Tulsa. Like, I don't know if like in the past it was just easier to cover it over because we don't know how to break that open and deal with it. But, you know, the reality is like stuff like that happens, and like how do we address that, especially as a church, you know? And like you said, accompaniment, like I think something that, you know, like the root of accompaniment is to eat, you know, bread with someone, accompany, right? You know, and it's like, that means you have to like be in some sort of relationship, right? And then even when you said the image and likeness of God, like, you know, we just had Trinity Sunday the other day, right? And we, sometimes we think, you know, God looks like a
like
person,
us.
Right?
Yeah. Right.
But like the true, like the Trinity, the image of the Trinity is really love, right? The love of the Father and the Son, and that relationship.
Right.
And that's what we're made in, to have relationship with each other. And you know, I think the closer we get there, the more we'll be able to shine light on these horrific things, not to to blame anyone, but to really ask God's mercy to enter the space, right?
Exactly.
Like we have to expose the wound so that we can, you know, not say that you're bad or, you know, whatever, you know, like to fight, but really how do we open it up so that we could actually walk together
and go forward.
Yeah.
I do know that when I look in the mirror in the morning, I don't think God looks like that.
I would be happy to find out God looked like you, Bob. I've been talking to God this whole time. No wonder you're so kind. But I will say though, I do see, you know, God working through you. So I appreciate that. Yeah.
That's very kind of you. I see the same for you.
Thank you.
So where do we go from here?
Well, I mean, so as part of the ad hoc committee against racism, you know, it's funny because we have like, you know, when it comes to sexuality, we have all the teachings, pornography, those things.
Right.
And racism is just something that like no one really wanted to touch, right? Or even believe it exists. So I think the acknowledgement that it's a thing, it's affected our church and beyond. So what we're doing is, you know, just kind of bringing that to light. There's no easy way to do it. So I like you said, I think accompaniment is going to be a key piece. And just really really listening to what people have gone through, listening to people who were affected. You know, maybe they're not alive, but they're the descendants, or they're still feeling the effects of like what happened in Tulsa, right?
Right.
Or, you know, in the boarding, or any of these horrific things. So it's, you know, allowing the space for people to heal, you know, even generationally, and society to heal, you know. So the committee is working on that, creating spaces where, one, you know, we could live out our Catholic faith in these spaces and allow it to, you know, to really shine on these, right, on these places. And then looking at what the sin of racism has done, even systematically, how it might have put people in privileged areas, and they might not even realize that. So how do you have a discussion, you know, with someone who might benefit from it, never asked to benefit from it, and is afraid to even talk to anyone about, you know, the fact that I benefit from this, right?
Sure.
You know, so that's kind of where we're going with this, you know. And then I think the big part was the listening sessions, and then Bishop Soto came out with a document too, you know, like our African American brothers and sisters.
Yeah, I would encourage everybody to read the bishop's bishop's statement on racism. It's really beautiful. It's beautifully written, but it's hard hitting.
It is.
It's got bullet points. It's got things we should be doing.
Yes.
It's a remarkable statement.
It is. And I, you know, thank God for Bishop Soto for really, you know, and recognizing that the African American Catholic population is very small, and you know, while there's many different ethnicities and races in the diocese, in particular, they're the ones that are the most hardest hit,
sure,
as far as even the community. You know, when we talked about earlier about having a community to go to, that's dwindling. So, yeah, so one of the bullet points is, you know, they're highlighting towards that. So that's,
And you can go on the diocese website, and I shared some highlights from it a couple of weeks ago. But very definitely, you can go on the website and read that one, and also a history of contribution despite a history of discrimination, which is also on the website about Asian American Pacific Islander as well.
Yeah, and his document on, or his pastoral letter on holiness, the call to holiness.
Oh yes,
yes. That, I mean, that's a good one to keep us like the frame right when dealing with the others.
That thing read like an encyclical.
Oh my gosh, it was beautiful,
wasn't it?
Yeah,
it was like, oh my goodness, why? Yeah. I get, you know, how do we get so blessed here?
Yeah,
you
Well,
it's named Sacramento. What do you expect?
That one we know the meaning to. Not like Solano and Yolo. We know Sacramento.
It's one of my favorite stories. I think I was in about the third or fourth grade in a public school, and we were talking about the history of Sacramento and, you know, old Sacramento and the floods and all that.
Yeah.
And I said, so what is Sacramento named for? And I knew, you know, and the teacher said, oh, I'm not sure I'll get back to you on that, you know. And about a week later, she calls me up after class and she says, I found out the answer to your question. I said, oh, what's the answer? And she said, it's named after the Sacramento River. Talk about a dodge.
You should ask her what the Sacramento River was named.
I did. And actually, I guess the Sacramento River preceded Sacramento. The naming of the river,
really?
Actually, that's the story I got. And it may be true.
Yeah.
That maybe whoever found this river and named it the Sacramento River, and then the city of Sacramento got founded on the river.
On the river, wow. Yeah.
So, but maybe that's
that
just
would be
a story too.
Yeah, I'm gonna actually see if I can find anything out. And I'll share it with you.
Very good.
Maybe the river was life giving. So they
yes,
called it.
Probably so. Yes. So. Yeah. It's nice to live in a diocese named after the Blessed Sacrament.
Yes, yes.
Well, Laura Lynn, we are against the clock, unfortunately.
No, it's okay.
We need to have you back soon.
Yeah. I always like talking to you.
So God bless you and your family.
God bless you, too.
We'll talk soon.
Okay.
Thanks
good.
So much. That's going to do it for us for today. Thanks for listening, everyone. God bless.
Can I pour my heart out to a listening ear? Well, I see this life, its valleys and mountains, and I think of all the roads that brought me here. Oh, that brought me here. Walking down the road. Well, I've questioned my reasons, this life I'm living. I question my ability to judge wrong from right. Well, I questioned all the things I've ever called certain. My race, my religion, my country.